messing up our relationship. Plus, if I was going to do this, I wanted his blessing. He gave it to me and felt it was a great opportunity for both me and the WWE, a complete 180 from his downfall mindset. Now that I had a clear schedule and a clear head, it was time to do what I'd always done when I set my mind on something. Kick ass and own it. First thing I decided to do was take private dance lessons of my own in Tampa. There was no way I was going to go on to one of the biggest shows on television with zero knowledge of what I was supposed to be doing. It wasn't easy, but after 40 hours of training, I had a basic understanding of the dances I was about to be performing. I was required to sign a confidentiality agreement and warned not to tell a soul I was going to be on the show. Then after a few weeks of radio silence, I flew to L.A. for the big cast reveal that was taking place after an episode of The Bachelor. When I arrived at the ABC studios, I was whisked away in secrecy like the Manchurian Candidate. I got out of the town car to walk inside, and two beefy bruisers in black suits and sunglasses held up a red curtain to shield me from the paparazzi hiding in the bushes, desperately trying to get an early shot of the highly anticipated new cast. Once safely inside the fortress, I was led into the green room to meet the rest of the cast, some of whom I recognized, Kirstie Alley, Sugar Ray Leonard, Ralph Macchio, some I didn't, Mike Catherwood, Lil Romeo, Hines Ward, and went through the awkward process of trying to get to know all of them in 5 minutes. We were given a quick briefing on how the reveal would go, and minutes later I was on stage in front of a live studio audience being introduced as a cast member on the 12th season of Dancing with the Stars. Just being announced as a contestant on the show elevated me to a different level of notoriety instantly. As huge and loyal as the American WWE fanbase was, with about 5 million people watching Raw weekly, EWTS had close to 25 million viewers each episode, and their fans were just as insatiable. They wanted to know every detail about the new cast, who our partners were going to be, what our personalities were like, and how we'd ended up on the show. I was besieged by reporters from every Hollywood gossip show and magazine, from Inside Edition, Entertainment Tonight, and Access Hollywood, to People, Star, and Us Weekly. EWTS was the crown jewel of network television, and the Hollywood cognoscenti lapped up every drop of its glitz and glamour accordingly. Even though I had name value from the WWE and Fozzy, in the eyes of the Hollywood entertainment press, I was still a niche celebrity. Kirstie, Ralph, and ditzy playmate Kendra Wilkinson were the A-listers in their minds, and were focused on the most. Initially, I believe they considered me the musclehead wrestler who would probably trip over his own feet and be eliminated in the first week. But I knew differently and made it my goal to change their perceptions of what WWE superstars and rock and roll singers were, for good. I was ecstatic when I found out I had been partnered with Cheryl Burke, the professional dancer on the show I was most familiar with. I remembered watching her during Stacy's season and thinking she was the best, so being paired with her gave me a feeling that I could do well. She came to Tampa for 3 weeks before the season premiere to train with me, and I liked her from the start. She was a great teacher in that she didn't tell me what I wanted to hear. She told me the truth, and the truth hurt a lot of the time. The first day we met, she put on some music and asked me to just dance to feel the rhythm of the music and do whatever felt natural. I lurched back and forth like Elaine Bennis, grooving to the beat with my eyes closed. When I opened them, Cheryl looked repulsed. Ugh, we've got a lot of work to do. She was right, and work we did, for 6 hours a day, 7 days a week, until I slowly started to get better. But dancing was one of the hardest things I'd ever done in my life. Learning how to hold my lines, a dancing term for keeping my arms and ankles straight, and to move my feet in time with the beat was hard as shit and frustrating. With a constant repetition and difficult physical exertion, it reminded me of when I first started training to wrestle. But I did have a few advantages from my other careers that helped me pick things up quicker. I was used to remembering choreography and distributing my weight gracefully from wrestling. I knew how to stay on top of the beat and how to follow the syncopation of the music from singing. Plus, my most potent weapon was knowing how to entertain a live audience and how to work the camera for those watching at home. When it came to that, I was a trained professional and wasn't going to freeze up while performing in front of 1,000 people in a studio audience cheering or booing me. But as the show came closer, I started to feel something I hadn't in a long time. Raw nerves. I'd main evented WrestleMania as the world champion and played with Fozzy in front of 25,000 people. But now I was about to do something I'd never done before in front of millions of people while getting critiqued by a panel of experts. What if they said I was awful? That I could take. But what if I was voted off in the first round like I'd been on Celebrity Duets? Read about that train wreck in my vocal instructional manual, Undisputed, available in music stores everywhere. That would be unbearable, and I vowed that no matter what, I would not get voted off first again. My ego couldn't handle it. For the next 3 weeks, Cheryl literally put me through my paces as we worked on our first week's dance, the Cha-Cha, set to Should I Stay or Should I Go by The Clash. Joe Strummer was rolling in his grave, knowing that his song was being used on Dancing with the Frickin' Stars, as a camera crew filmed our every move. We broke down the 90-second dance into sections, meticulously practicing each one over and over again until it began to take shape. There were certain parts I did well, the quick footwork and spins, and other parts I didn't, shaking my hips and landing a jump at the beginning. But with Cheryl's guidance and tough love style of coaching, I started to believe that I could actually pull it off. We moved from Tampa back to L.A. for our last week of training, and that's when it hit me how massive a spectacle DWTS really was. Every day, camera crews from the entertainment shows came into the studio to interview us and document our progress, while our own camera crew filmed them filming us. There were costume design sessions and fittings orchestrated by Cheryl, who not only designed all of our choreography, but our outfits as well. We had to film our routine, or our wides, every Friday so that the producers could gauge what kind of progress we were making. On Sundays, there was a full dress rehearsal with the 40-piece band. Cheryl warned me that no matter how good or bad the rehearsal went, under no circumstances should we ever stop midway through. There were photo sessions, press interviews, appearances, and of course the nonstop rehearsing that went up to 7 hours a day, every day, with no break for lunch. There was no reason to eat anyway, since we didn't have the time or the desire to. Dancing was hard enough as is without trying to do it on a full stomach. The training was so strenuous that I began to lose a lot of weight, although it was nothing compared to Kirstie Alley, who dropped over 50 pounds during her tenure on the show. After a few days, I noticed that, like in wrestling, the producers wanted us all to have a gimmick. Kirstie was the wacky comedic actress, Kendra the ditzy no-filter playmate, Ralph the baby-faced ageless wonder, Hines the quiet yet charming athlete, and I was the wild cartoony wrestler. I think the last time the producers watched the WWE, Hulk Hogan was the champion, because they wanted me to act just like him. But to paraphrase Rob Halford, they had another thing coming. "Okay, we want you to rip your shirt off and growl at the camera," the director said while we were filming the opening show credits. Rip my shirt off? I'd never ripped my shirt off once during my 20-year career, and I wasn't about to start now. Besides, if I was going to go anywhere on this show, I was going to have to appeal to dancing fans, not wrestling fans. I doubted many of the WWE universe were going to be watching me anyways, as DWTS aired on Mondays against Raw. Plus, I'd been the most hated heel in the company the last time they saw me. So I was going to have to rely on my charm and personality to get over, not my muscles and Y2J character. "I'm not going to rip off my shirt. It's not really my thing," I told the director with a smile. "But just roll the camera. I'll give you what you want." I shuffle-stepped my way toward the camera with an intense look and grabbed it with both hands, shaking it around like a psycho circus clown. The director loved it and had me do a few different takes, gathering the execs around to watch me mug for the camera. They realized right then that I wasn't their mama's stereotypical wrestler. I was a totally different animal. I was Chris Jericho. The day of the season premiere arrived, and as I put on my costume and got my hair and makeup done, I was clutched in the terrifying grip of my nerves. I practiced the steps over and over in my trailer and listened to Metallica's Battery to get into the zone. That had to be a first in DWTS history, until I was given the 10-minute warning. I stood backstage shaking and looking for the exit door, in case I needed an escape hatch. But as soon as our names were announced, I calmed down completely because it was now time to do the damn thing. We hit the lights and the routine began as I leapt off the stage with bursting energy and landed in a perfect power slide that would have made Jables proud. My nerves disappeared as I spun Cheryl around like a fiery top, both pairs of our feet moving in perfect Spiritus Mundi synchronicity. 90 seconds of tight turns and hot moves later, I dipped her into our final pose, and a blast of pyro exploded into the air as the crowd sprang to their feet in applause. I looked around the packed studio with a shark's grin. Not everything had gone perfectly. One of the few removable arms in my costume hadn't actually removed, and I'd messed up a few of the steps, but overall I was damn glad it was finished and was happy with my performance. Thankfully, the judges agreed, and even though they gave me a few harsh critiques, Len Goodman said my hips looked like they were cemented into place, they praised me overall and awarded us a solid 19 out of 30 score. Not bad for my first try, good enough to put me in the middle of the pack and to give me the confidence I needed to know that I could survive this contest, and maybe even thrive in it. My confidence was boosted even further the next night during the results show, when it was announced halfway through that I'd made it into the second round. Mission accomplished, baby. Funny man Mike Catherwood was the first one eliminated, and I deemed my duet's denunciation disintegrated. Our dance for week two was the quick step set to I Got Rhythm. It was a total 180 to move from The Clash to Judy Garland, and hearing her song on constant repeat during that week's rehearsals drove me nuts. Who could ask for anything more? But after a while, it was like working at a bell factory, and I just stopped noticing. While the cha-cha was Latin-based and revolved around the moving of the hips, which I had trouble with, the quick step was all about fancy footwork and presentation, and I took to it instantly. Before too long, Cheryl and I were gliding around the rehearsal hall in an intricate syncopated routine that I loved. She had designed a 1940s-style baby blue outfit to match the vibe of this song, and I slicked my hair back for that suave and debonair look. It also made me look uncannily like my next protege, Wade Barrett. We absolutely killed it on show day, and the judges heaped praise upon us, congratulating me on my vast improvement. Bruno Tonioli jumped on his desk, waving his arms excitedly, calling me a dancing beast in his over-the-top Italian accent, which was apparently a high-level compliment, while Carrie Ann Inaba said I was a true contender. As we awaited our scores, I told a few on-camera jokes to show off my personality, which was my goal every week. I figured if I could make people laugh, it might get the people who didn't already know me from the WWE on my side faster. I felt if I could charm the granny panties off of the middle American housewives, I'd have a better chance of hanging around longer. A few minutes later, we got our scores, but after all the amazing praise, I was a little disappointed when I only got 23 out of 30. The judges' scores didn't match their gushing comments, and I didn't understand why. However, Team Cherico still did well enough to advance to the next round, and we went back to the dancing board. The third week had a personal story theme, and I decided to do a tribute to my mom, sweet Loretta Modern, with a rumba to Let It Be by the Beatles. The dance was preceded by a video package where I told the story of my mom's tragic accident and how it still affected me to this day. It was an emotional experience to put together that special dance for her. Cheryl's choreography was incredible. And the stage designers upped the ante by designing a set featuring a large framed photograph of Loretta on top of an old-time phonograph. The camera zoomed in on the picture as I put the needle on the record, and the performance began. I thought the combination of her story and the raw emotion of the dance would grab the audience by the heartstrings and pull me through to the next round easily. But the judges felt differently. Even though my transitions weren't as smooth as the week before and the dance didn't click like the quick step had, I felt they were a little harsh. My tango was mildly panned by the judges and given a score of 21. I feel I was underscored, which led me to the final elimination position with daytime talk show host Wendy Williams. The two of us stood under the hot spotlights like death row inmates waiting to ride the lightning. Time moving slow, the minutes seemed like hours, and my heart raced like Jeff Gordon as I contemplated my fate. Would I stay, or would I go? It was the worst mindfuck ever, and when they announced Wendy was eliminated, I felt no sense of triumph, no feeling of a job well done. I felt like I had advanced by default, like winning a silver medal. I'm assuming they put me in the kill zone to encourage anybody who liked me but hadn't voted to get off their asses and pick up the phone next week. I also noticed that the scores in general were higher this week, almost as if they didn't want to give out the bigger scores too early in the competition. In my opinion, if I would have done the exact same quick step in week 3 that I'd done in week 2, I might have scored a 25 or 26. Had I peaked too early? My performance the next week proved that wasn't the case. If there was anybody watching at home still sitting on the fence about me, I'm sure I convinced them of my prowess after my week 4 Paso Doble. It was orchestra week, and Team Cherico performed the famous Latin bullfighting dance to the tune of Grieg's In the Hall of the Mountain King. I'd been a fan of Sabotage's version for years, and it was my favorite performance of the 7 weeks I was on the show. It was highlighted by me marching across the dance floor on my knees, completely in time with the music, an amazing Cheryl idea that had never been done on DWTS before. I put my wrestling knee pads under my tight satin pants to protect my knees, and the move tore the house down. We got a standing ovation from the live audience, and I had 42 texts congratulating me when I got back to my trailer, and even a voicemail from my bro Sebastian Bach saying, "Dude, your Paso Robles was fucking great." However, once again the judges felt differently, and I was legitimately pissed off at their comments this time, especially Len Goodman's jab that I had no idea how to follow the beat. That was total bullshit, but their disdain for my dance worried me because I had to make it through to the next round. If I did, I was going to get the chance to appear on the program I'd been dreaming about being on since I was a kid. The Tonight Show. Jay Leno's producers had agreed to book me as a guest that week as long as I was still an active participant on DWTS. So that had been my motivation for the last 7 days. I had to kill the Paso Doble so I could advance to the next round and be on The Tonight Show. Thankfully, I didn't have to wait until the last elimination again this week, as my score of 23 was good enough to advance me to week 5. It was official. I was going to be on Leno. I was a huge Johnny Carson fan as a kid, and had been watching The Tonight Show my whole life. Some of my earliest childhood memories are of going on vacation with my parents and drifting off to sleep while listening to Johnny's voice in the hotel room while my mom and dad watched him from the next bed. For me, after everything I'd done, to be on The Tonight Show was the true sign of making it. If you hadn't been on Carson or Leno, then you weren't shit. And now that I'd been invited on, I was the shit. But I needed some fancy new duds to wear on my big night, so on the recommendation of wise cousin Chad, I went to the John Varvatos store on Melrose Avenue and bought a brand new suit. "Can you have this for me by Thursday?" I asked the salesman. "I'm going to be on The Tonight Show, so I need to have it ready." Nothing made me feel fruiter than saying that, even though the guy barely batted an eye and couldn't have cared less. It was Hollywood, so I'm sure he heard that line every day. I did the pre-interview with one of the segment producers and gave her a myriad, amazing word, of ideas for Jay and me to talk about, not wanting to leave anything out. I was the second guest on the show, which meant if I could get 5 minutes of airtime, I'd be lucky. So I wanted to give them an overabundance of material to make sure I got the absolute most out of the little time I had. Finally, the night arrived, and I was relaxing in my personal Tonight Show dressing room, hashtag Big Shot, when Jay Leno himself walked in. He was wearing a denim shirt and blue jeans, the Canadian tuxedo, and chatted with me for a few moments about our previous meeting at Road Wild 1998, the WCW PPV where he wrestled Hulk Hogan. If you don't know the story, Google it, 'cause you ain't gonna read it here, and wished me luck. After he left, I took a second to drink in the moment of being in my private room in beautiful downtown Burbank, about to appear on the most famous talk show of all time. "I'm ready for my close-up, Mr. Leno." The first guest that night was the crimson-haired Diane Lane, who I had a huge crush on when she played Cherry Valance in The Outsiders in 1983. She was still hot, but kind of boring, and her segment dragged on and on and on and on. I went to sleep the other night, blah, 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 with my windows open, and ever so softly, blah, blah, the crickets were chirping. The crickets were chirping all right, and tumbleweeds were blowing through the studio as both the audience and Jay were practically falling asleep. Finally, she ended her funeral dirge of an interview, and it was time for me to pump up the volume in that mug and steal the show. I bounded onto the stage with a burst of much-needed energy, and the vibe in the studio changed instantly. My game plan was to talk as much as possible, to not give Jay any openings to end the interview and my segment. I began by saying how excited I was to be on The Tonight Show, and told a joke about Sammy Davis and Lola Falana that died a death. I also wanted to walk on stage holding a martini like Dean Martin in the 60s, but that was nixed down by the producers. But I recovered quickly and continued on about how I was used to wearing spandex and rhinestones, so I had no problem with the costumes on DWTS. Then I talked about my penchant for chewing only blue gum, none of that stinkin' cinnamon, before all of my performances, how my Uncle Russ was a dead ringer for Jay. They flashed his picture on screen, and he called me the next day to express how excited he was that he'd finally made it onto The Tonight Show, and how my son Ash had told everyone he knew to vote for me on DWTS. "He knows like 10 people," I said flippantly. My quip got a laugh, but I felt terrible afterward when Jessica told me I'd hurt Ash's feelings deeply because he really had told all his friends at school to vote for me. He was my biggest fan, and I had insulted him. Ugh, I'm such an idiot, and I'm really sorry, Ash man. Frankly, all three of my kids enjoyed watching me on the show, and since none of them were big WWE fans, my being on DWTS finally made me fruit in their eyes. Cheyenne and Sierra liked the fancy costumes and thought Cheryl was a princess. Ash liked the whole spectacle and had a blast when he came to watch me perform live. My interview was going great, but I kept gulping water out of the mug on Jay's desk and buttoning and unbuttoning my suit jacket constantly, subtly showing how nervous I was. But I channeled my inner Robin Williams, my all-time favorite talk show guest, as I got up from my chair, used silly voices, and generally made fun of myself. I kept waiting for Jay to cut me off, but he never did, so I just kept on talking, until finally after 9.5 minutes he thanked me and went to commercial. Wait, 9.5 minutes? That was the same amount of time Diane Lane got, and was unheard of for a second guest. I had just killed it on The Tonight Show, and mentally Barry Horowitz to myself as the crowd applauded. Jay was ecstatic about the interview, thanking me more than once and asking me to come back any time. I haven't been invited back since. I thanked him in return and took another sip of fine H2O from the mug on his desk. Then I saw another mug of water on the coffee table in front of me. I looked back at the mug on Jay's desk. If that mug was on his desk, then that meant it belonged to... Jay, have I been drinking your water the whole time?
"It's okay. I've got plenty of mugs," he said in his famous squeaky voice.
I smiled sheepishly as an assistant hurriedly brought him a fresh water and whisked my cootie-infested mug away. The next week, our dance was the Viennese Waltz, a ballroom routine that entailed nonstop spinning and twirling. A big problem for me. These days, if I do even one spin, it makes me feel a little nauseous, which I'm pretty sure is some sort of side effect from over 20 years of taking bumps. I was feeling sick after the first rehearsal and wondered if I'd be able to pull this one off. But behind every good man there is an amazing woman, and mine pirouetted in and saved the day. Jess suggested I try wearing C-bands, which are cheap woven bracelets with a small white marble in the center that presses against a pressure point and alleviates all motion sickness and nausea. So I gave them a try, and thankfully they worked like a charm, allowing me to give my best performance of the competition. Thanks for saving the day yet again, sweetie. You're the best wife ever. It was America Week, and while we weren't dancing to Sister Golden Hair, much to my chagrin, our music was Whitney Houston's version of America the Beautiful. We once again stole the show. Our costumes, choreography, and charisma all came together, and led to our tightest and best performance of the competition. In weeks prior, even during my good dances, I'd felt a moment or two of trepidation on a few of the steps, but in week 5, everything was second nature. We were rewarded with a 26, our highest score to date, and even cranky curmudgeon Len Goodman gave us an 8 and a standing ovation. However, my victory was short-lived and tainted by another final 2-elimination moment. It pissed me off to have to stand on the hot spot again after such a great performance, knowing there was no way I could be going home but still feeling that little worm of doubt that I might be wrong. Supermodel Petra Nemkova ended up getting axed, but after another mentally taxing torture session, I was angry again. I ain't talking about Dave Mustaine. I felt like the producers were messing with me, even though in retrospect I think they were just giving the fans one last warning to vote for me. Once again, there was a reward for making it through the round, and even though it wasn't quite as prestigious as being on The Tonight Show, it was pretty damn close. By surviving week 5, I earned the right to be a guest on Ellen. Ellen's producers had the same policy as Leno's. I had to still be in the running for DWTS champion if they were going to have Cheryl and me on as guests. Since we had advanced, we were booked. Ellen's vibe was a lot different from Jay's, and I was told straight off that if she didn't like me, she would end the segment when she felt like it, no matter how short it was. I arrived at the studio and got on the elevator when a voice shouted, "Hold the door!" I hit the open button and on walked Tom Cruise and his bodyguard, who looked, as my dad would say, like a cigarette machine with a head on it. Cruise's hair was immaculate, his features perfect, and he was shorter than I expected, but his presence was overwhelming. It's awkward enough to stand next to a stranger within the close confines of an elevator car, but try doing it with one of the most famous people in the world. Tom stared straight ahead, and I wondered what would happen if I struck up a conversation. "Hi," I said. It was all I could think of. Tom glanced my way for a nanosecond and slightly nodded, but I could tell by his reaction and his body language that he had no interest in talking to me. We arrived at our floor, and Tom glided off with his sycophants as I coughed from the secondhand Scientology that filled the air. 30 minutes, I was announced as Ellen's next guest, and I could tell from her lackadaisical intro that she didn't really know who I was and couldn't care less about me. I was proven right when her first few comments were so cold they would have made Mick Jagger's hand freeze. I knew I had to warm her up, and soon, or she would cut off my segment like John Wayne Bobbitt's cock, and that would be that. I felt strangely comfortable with her, though, as I'd watched Finding Nemo with my kids so many times, I knew her character Dory's lines by heart. "You know, Ellen, I feel like I know you already because I've seen Finding Nemo so many times with my kids. As a matter of fact, it's nice to finally hear you say something other than P. Sherman, 42 Wallaby Way, Sydney, Australia." That got a nice laugh and broke the ice between us. From that moment on, Ellen was friendly, charming, and funny. We had a great interview, and after a good 7 minutes, she asked me if I would stay until the next segment and play a game. I agreed, and she led me over to play Twister Hoopla, which was basically standing Twister, except you played with a partner and had to use each other's body parts to hold up various hoops. I was excited about playing, but not about being put against my old downfall rival Mario Lopez. I'd seen Mario around over the years, and we'd done a few shows together, but for whatever reason, he'd always rubbed me the wrong way. "Hello, Lopez," I said with a sneer.
"Hello, Jericho," he said with false sincerity.
I didn't care what I had to do. There was no way I was letting A.C. Slater beat me in anything. I could tell by the look in his eye that he felt the same way, but we maintained our fake smiles as Ellen picked 2 housewives from the audience to be our partners. Twister Hoopla started out easy enough as Ellen spun 2 wheels with different body parts drawn on them, one for me and one for my partner Jane. It landed on elbow and shoulder, so I had to pick up a ring off the ground and hold it to her shoulder with my elbow. Lopez and his partner had to hold up their ring with his knee on her hip. Ellen continued spinning the wheel for a few minutes until all 4 of us were straining our bodies desperately, trying not to let any of the rings fall. While most of your garden-variety Ellen guests, like Hugh Jackman or Dr. Oz, would have given up with a good-natured laugh at this point, Lopez and I were locked in a duel to the death, and we were taking the Real Housewives of Studio County along with us. Not that they minded, as the prospect of a 60-inch HD color TV—are there any black-and-white ones? was much too enticing to give up on. For 10 minutes, the four of us contorted our bodies into positions that would have made the cast of Cirque du Soleil puke, our muscles straining and tendons stretching to the limits as Ellen called out directions. I had just stuck the point of my chin against Jane's thigh, the red ring dangling precariously between us, when my eyes locked with Lopez.
"You know you can't win," I mouthed.
"You'll never beat me," Lopez whispered.
"Shut up and concentrate. I want my color TV," Jane threatened.
Realizing that the game could go on for the duration of the show if she let it, Ellen called it off and ruled it a tie. I was a little annoyed because I knew I could have beaten Lopez with a few more minutes, but thanked her for ending it early the next day when I was so sore I could barely get out of bed. I've fallen off 15-foot-high steel cages, lost my front teeth to a stainless steel ladder, and done 500 hack squats with Chris Benoit, but I've never felt my muscles in as much pain as they were that next day. "Twister hoopla is hardcore! Twister hoopla is hardcore! Twister hoopla is hardcore!" I was having a great run on DWTS and felt I was getting better with every performance. But as Cheryl and I were rehearsing our tango to Journey's Don't Stop Believin', the evil song I'd picked for Guilty Pleasures Week, I couldn't quite grasp the choreography for some reason. I kept forgetting the moves and was the proverbial 2 steps behind the whole time. I was doing more rehearsals that week than I had for any other, but I just wasn't getting it. Neither was Heinz Ward, apparently, as I found him sitting morosely by himself in the corner one afternoon. His dance was the same Viennese waltz I'd done the week before, and he was having similar issues with dizziness. So I reached into my bag of tricks and pulled out the C-bands.
"You've got to try these, man. They'll take care of everything," I said.
He put them on warily, thanking me for my help. Team Chirico continued practicing diligently throughout the week. But when we had to do our wides on Friday, I kept screwing up, and it took a few tries to get something semi-decent. I was sure the producers formulated their initial opinions of our dances from the wides, but since we still had 3 days of practice left, I thought I'd be okay come showtime. Then, 2 days later, disaster struck during the full band dress rehearsal when I screwed up some steps and stopped halfway through. Cheryl looked like she'd just seen Fred Astaire's ghost as the air seemed to get sucked out of the studio.
"You can't stop," she said with dismay.
Well, I just did, and I didn't see the big deal. If I was rehearsing a song with Fozzie and messed it up, I'd stop and we'd do it again. That's why it's called rehearsal, right? But seeing everyone's reaction when I stopped, combined with the lack of info about the next week's dance, suggested that we might be the ones going home that week. Even though I had surprised the producers with my performances and personality, I felt like my time was up with the judges, and no matter how well I danced, they'd already made up their minds. My thoughts were validated when I watched my pre-dance video package and it had the classic DWTS foreboding, "These guys are in trouble" tone to it. It was funny because out of the nonstop 50 hours we had rehearsed that week, I took a half-day break to see Metallica at the Big Four Festival in nearby Indio, California. There was only 1 3-minute stretch early on where I'd gotten mad at my progress, yelling, "I can't do this!" in frustration. Of course, the video package was based entirely on that one outburst. They even ran it in slow motion, giving people the impression that I didn't know what I was doing that week. I'm a big show player, and as soon as the red light went on and we went live, I delivered my best tango performance of the week. But I wasn't completely happy with it, nor was I completely happy with the finishing move of the routine. I spun Cheryl around by her arms and pitched her across the floor like a curling rock, but I felt a small pop and a flash of pain in my back as I did it. The pain of a bruised ego soon followed when, in a low-blow statement, Bruno told me in his Santino Marella accent that I looked like a lump of granite during my dance. Len disagreed and gave me another 8, but it was obvious that I'd gone from last week's golden child to this week's shit baby. When our final score of 21 ended up being that week's lowest, I knew our fate was sealed, especially when I was once again on one of the final 2 in the elimination circle. However, this time there was no reprieve, and I was given the axe. I was sad to be eliminated, but it was almost a relief, as I'd been away from home for 7 weeks and was looking forward to being a daddy again. The amount of press coverage I'd gotten over the previous 2 months was incredible, and I ended up as one of the media darlings of the season. I got a ton of you-got-robbed comments from journalists, fans, and friends, which is always better than hearing you were dog shit and it's about time you got kicked off. In reality, I think I was good enough to last another week or two at the most, but there was no way I was as good a dancer as Ralph, Kirsty, or the eventual winner, Hines, who might not have even made it past week 6 if it hadn't been for my C-bands. I should get an endorsement for this. You owe me one, Ward. I still walked away a winner as I got to learn a little about the incredible art form of dancing, and took a chance and succeeded at something completely out of my wheelhouse. Bret Hart even said I had big brass balls for doing the show. I used to think dancing was stupid and just for effeminate tough guys, but I came out of that experience thinking just the opposite. Dancing is one of the hardest but most rewarding things I've ever done. Plus, working with Cheryl Burke was simply amazing, and she made things easier and fun. We spent so much time together over those 10 weeks and became close friends, and I miss hanging out with her. For the record, I still think she's the best dancer on the show to this day. Overall, Stacy was right. Doing DWTS was one of the best experiences of my career, and I'm proud of myself and very thankful that I did it. P.S. Here's some trivia for you. Don't Stop Believin' is the evil song that eliminated me from Dancing with the Stars, my bro James Durbin from American Idol, and Tony Soprano from The Sopranos. Piss off, Neil Scone. Chapter 39. Yeah, boy! Right after my elimination, even though my back was in some serious pain, I did the Jimmy Kimmel Show to discuss my ousting, then hit the town to drown my sorrows with The Miz, who witnessed my elimination live in the studio, and my old friend Paul Gargano. We got totally load-ski and stayed up all night getting our yah-yahs out, which was the perfect way to blow off steam and wind up my DWTS experience. But when I went back to my apartment at 5 a.m., there was a car waiting to take me to my appearance on Good Morning America, a mandatory chore for eliminated contestants that I had totally forgotten about. This was not good, for I was a complete mess, as in the slurred speech can't talk might puke at any minute type of mess. I showed up at the studio wearing the exact same clothes I'd worn on Kimmel the night before and slumped down next to Cheryl. She was getting mic'd up for our live interview via satellite with George Stephanopoulos in New York City. We'd spent enough time together over the past 2.5 months. We'd even done a few joint book signings when our books came out at the same time, and Undisputed made it all the way to number 9 on the New York Times bestseller list, that she knew exactly what state I was in. Even though she was sitting right beside me, I took out my phone and clumsily texted her. I'm loaded. Not sure I can talk right now, so you might have to handle this for me. She nodded, and we went live. But once again, I'm a big show player, and as soon as the red light came on, I snapped into charming Jericho mode and took over the segment. It was like when I used to come home drunk as a teenager and had to trick my mom into thinking I was sober. If I could fool sweet Loretta Modern into thinking I wasn't hammered, tricking 10 million viewers was going to be a piece of cake. I made jokes, graciously talked about my elimination, and said that I bowed out of the competition on purpose because I'd been invited to the royal wedding in England that weekend. I left him laughing, and the ABC publicist said I was the best eliminated guest yet. Even Gargano said he couldn't tell I was bombed, and he'd been right beside me drinking all night. I went back to my apartment to crash, and when I woke up, I checked my emails for the day's DWTS schedule. I was surprised that I hadn't gotten anything. Then I remembered I'd been eliminated, and it was a weird feeling having to adjust to life after DWTS. I had serious dance withdrawal and paced around my apartment like a junkie looking for things to do. I'd been training 7 hours a day, 7 days a week for 10 weeks, and now that that had been taken away, there was a huge void for me both mentally and physically. Not that I could do a lot physically, as my back was really bad. It was getting hard to pick something up off the floor, getting into my car, go to the gym, sleep, or even sneeze without feeling sharp pains. And I was starting to get worried. A few weeks later, Cheryl and I got back together to run through our routine for the season finale, but things had changed. We both wanted to do well, but the intensity was gone now that there was nothing at stake. We practiced for hours instead of days and put together a loose routine of my greatest hits from previous dances. The knee walk, The big jump off the stage and pitching Cheryl down the floor like a curling rock all made the cut. We'd been paired with Sugar Ray Leonard in a mock boxing versus wrestling dance-off, complete with ring intros from Michael Buffer. I'd met Buffer a few times when Eric Bischoff had paid him big money to introduce the main events at WCW PPVs in the 90s, but he'd never announced any of my matches. After all this time, to finally hear his famous voice booming out my name was pretty damn fruit, even if it was just for a dance recital and not a match. Our routine went well, even though my back screamed when I pitched Cheryl down the floor, and it was a change to just have fun with a dance and not to worry about getting judged. Plus, all I really cared about was getting a chance to do the Bruno imitation I'd been practicing ever since he'd low-blowed me with his final comments. I had it all planned out, and asked host Tom Bergeron on the down-low to inquire during the post-dance interview what I'd been up to. After our performance, Tom asked me the question, and I said I'd been working on a Bruno imitation, and wondered if the audience wanted to see it. Of course they did, so I went into a wild and wacky frantic tirade in perfect over-the-top Bruno-ese, jumping up on the table and kicking my legs flamboyantly.
"Bruno, the dancing judge, flailing his arms about and holding his words for no apparent reason."
My imitation tore the house down, and Carrie Ann and Abba gave me my first and only 10 of the competition. Afterward, a producer pulled me aside and sternly said that even though my imitation was hilarious, he was a little annoyed that I hadn't gotten it approved beforehand, and that it had gone on too long. Oh well, it's always easier to ask for forgiveness than for permission, right? The second Cheryl spin had aggravated my back injury even further, and after the DWTS finale it got progressively worse. I felt a constant slicing in my calf, as if there were a tiny imp sawing on me with a hacksaw 24/7. I'd wake up every few hours in terrible pain, unable to get out of bed. I was in a bad way and couldn't take it any longer. So I went for an MRI, which discovered a herniated disc. The doctor said there were a few things I could try to alleviate the agony, but most likely I needed surgery to fuse my spine, and that my wrestling career was now in jeopardy. It was ridiculous to think that I'd wrestled for over 20 years with hardly any injuries, but a couple months of dancing was enough to bring the hammer down on my career for good. I'm sure the 2 decades of constant punishment had loosened the lid of my peanut butter jar, and dancing was just the final twist, but either way, I had to make some decisions. My first decision was there was no way I was getting back surgery. HBK had a similar procedure and had eventually returned to wrestling, but it had taken him 5 years to do so. I didn't want to wait 5 years. Plus, I felt that at almost 40, if I had surgery, I might not be able to come back. I was going to have to find another way to cure my problem. There had to be something I could do that, combined with my iron will, a.k.a. stubbornness, would make the pain go away. I weighed my options and, a few weeks later, went for the first of 3 epidurals, the same pain-killing shots Jess got while giving birth, which worked for a few days until the agony was unwelcomed back like Cotter. I started going for acupuncture a few times a week, which helped a little, but I was losing the war as the pain was affecting me both physically and emotionally now. I was cranky and easily irritated and snapping at Jess and the kids constantly because I never knew when the sawing would start. I was about to resign myself to surgery when Diamond Dallas Page stepped in. One day, after an acupuncture session, I posted a picture on Twitter, at IamJericho, of my back pierced with 12 needles, and got a call 20 minutes later from an unknown number. I had just sat down for lunch at Burger 21 in Tampa, best in the world at what they do, and when I checked the voicemail afterward, it was Paige.
"Bro, I saw your picture and you need to call me now." I hadn't spoken to DDP in years, but I had been following his new career as a yoga guru. I figured he was trying to try and get me to start doing his program, but I had no interest. Yoga is for hippies, women, and effeminate tough guys, I thought to myself. Then a sharp razor blade of pain sliced through my leg, making me wince, and I reconsidered my mindset. I called DDP a few minutes later. I explained the problems I was having, and he knew exactly what I was going through. He'd herniated not just 1 but 2 discs in the mid-90s and was told by doctors he would never wrestle again. He too decided he wasn't going to accept that diagnosis,
and designed his own yoga program to help with the pain. A few months later, he was totally cured and went on to win the WCW world title 3 times. He sold me on his program hard, and at the end of the conversation, I reluctantly agreed to give it a try. He promised to send me his DVDs with the caveat that I would actually follow through and do the program. That wasn't a problem. I had no other choice. The first couple of sessions were awful, as I could barely bend over without yelping in pain. I'd prided myself during my career on never warming up before a match, and my horrible current flexibility reflected that. I couldn't touch my toes and had zero balance, and trying to execute the various poses was causing me excruciating agony. Since Page had created his own style of yoga, he'd renamed the classic poses to fit his wrestling background. The Showstopper, the Road Warrior, the Cobra, and created some poses of his own, including the Hulk-Up and the patented Diamond Cutter. I felt like a total mark when I first did the Diamond Cutter pose while yelling bang in an empty room, since Page used to incessantly push his catchphrase back in WCW ad nauseam. If Benoit and Eddie could see me now, they'd be laughing their asses off and calling me a fop, friends of Page, the dreaded nickname for Page's disciples back in the day. Over the next few weeks, the poses got easier as my flexibility improved, and I started to see a difference. The pain was still there, but the volume had been turned down. It got increasingly better, and after 3 months of daily, sometimes twice daily, sessions, I was pain-free. It was a miracle, and I ain't talking about Smokey Robinson, or his lemons. The curious thing was, not only was I free of pain from the herniation, I was pain-free, period. Before my back injury, I used to climb out of bed feeling 100 years old, knees tight, back sore, and neck stiff. But now I bounded out of bed like a kid at 6 o'clock on a Christmas morning. The only time I felt any pain was when I got lazy and didn't do any yoga for a few days. Nowadays, I don't lift weights or go to the gym very often. It's all DDP yoga, push-ups, and boxing training. The best thing about DDP yoga is I can do it anywhere, outside the tour bus, in the dressing room, or in my hotel. Gone are the days of having to schlep around town looking for a gym. Now I carry the gym on my computer. Page's program not only saved my career, but my quality of life as well, and for that I am eternally grateful. I highly recommend it to anybody experiencing any kind of pain, no matter how big or small. If you are having issues, go to www.ddpyoga.com now for more info and tell him CJ sent you. So thank you, DDP. I'm proud to be a fop and am happy to have felt the bang. After GWTS and DDP Yoga, I'd lost a lot of weight, which was something I'd been concentrating on doing ever since I stepped on a scale after Ash's 7th birthday on September 24, 2010. I'd spent the day eating chicken fingers and drinking beer, and that evening I weighed 230 pounds. I was about to turn, lordy, lordy, look who's 40, and was getting middle-aged chunky, so I decided right then and there that homie don't play that. I haven't drunk a beer since, and that, along with the dancing and the yoga, helped me drop almost 18 pounds. But with no more beer and no more brown alcohol allowed for Fat Jericho, I had to find something else to drink when it was time to rock the party. That's when I invented the Yeah Boy. For my 40th birthday, I chartered a plane and flew my all-time favorite party pals and their wives to Turks and Caicos for a week of drunk in the sun. In order to be invited, you had to be obsessed with music and love to drink, which eliminated some of my closest friends, but left me with just the cream of the party crop. I assembled quite the rogues gallery of rockers, including Wise Chad, his brother, my cousin, and the nicest guy in the world, Todd. What's the good word? Crazy Eyes Spee-Wee, Ribo, Ajax, and Lenny Olson, a.k.a. Dr. Luther, and the best man at my wedding. It was in the midst of the nonstop party that I discovered I liked the taste of straight vodka with ice and no pollutants. I was sick of drinking cocktails where the sugar in the mix made you bloated and got you hungover, so I had the genius idea of drinking the vodka with ice only. That's when the official cocktail of Chris Jericho was born, Grey Goose and Ice, a.k.a. the Yeah Boy, as coined by Fozzie's Pauly D. Well, it might sound harsh at first. My father-in-law, Ronnie Lockhart, calls it a true alcoholic's drink, and he may be right. The good news is you will never get a hangover from drinking one. Ever. Now, while you might end up tired the next day, you can say goodbye to the pounding head and puking. Think about it. The remedy for avoiding a hangover is to drink water to hydrate yourself throughout the night, right? So by using only ice as my mix, I'm already a step ahead. So, fearless readers, if you follow Dr. Jericho's prescription, you will never get another hangover again. Or at least that's what I tell myself. Yeah, boy! Chapter 40, The Billy Crystal of Heavy Metal. I was at Raw in Columbus when I got a call from Josh Bernstein from Revolver Magazine, the biggest heavy metal publication in America, and the creators of the Golden Gods, the first ever heavy metal award show. He wanted to know if I'd like to be a presenter of one of the awards at the ceremony, but in typical Jericho fashion, I told him I'd rather host it instead. After a few back-and-forth calls, I was hired to be the co-host along with Andrew W.K. I flew to L.A. for the press conference at the Rainbow on the Sunset Strip in Hollywood, along with Lemmy, Dave Mustaine, my bro Zach Wilde, Chuck Billy, Rob Halford, and Vinnie Paul. It was quite the array of legends and a good indication of the star power that was going to be in attendance at the show. The second annual Golden Gods Awards was a huge success, kicking off with an opening vignette of W.K. and me riding down the Sunset Strip on Rob Halford's Harley and pulling up right onto the stage of the Nokia Theater. None more metal. The crowd who filled the Nokia were there to have a good time, but were also wild and unruly. I had no problems shutting up the hecklers, as I'd had plenty of practice dealing with loudmouths on a microphone. But poor Andrew W.K. wasn't as verbally equipped and looked like he wanted to disappear when they started chanting, "Camel toe! Camel toe!" at him in his dirty off-white jeans. I was the opposite. When they booed Lars Ulrich during a video he sent in congratulating the show, I told them all to shut the hell up and reminded them if he was actually there, they'd be lining up to blow him in adulation. Lars did show up the following year, and I did too after being named the sole host of the show. Josh and the Revolver head honcho said I was welcome to host the show for as long as he was in charge. I was now the Billy Crystal of heavy metal. I looked forward to doing the show since it was like Hard Rock Summer Camp, a place where, once a year, everybody saw all of their friends and some familiar faces. Bumpershine. Ozzy walked past me backstage, giggling, "Who the fuck are you, man?" and then literally had no idea who the fuck I was an hour later when I introduced him to present an award. He walked out on stage, and when I opened my arms to give him a big hug, he shambled right past me without a glance. It was the ultimate burn. I brushed it off and went backstage where I saw Gene Simmons. I'd never met him before, so I went and introduced myself. "Hey, Gene, I'm Chris Jericho, the host of the show."
"Ah, aren't you a handsome man?" he said, smiling lasciviously. "I would fuck you if I saw you in prison."
"Not if I saw you first," I replied, not missing a beat. Gene nodded his head with a silent touché. I introduced Ronnie James Dio, I didn't spill red wine on him this time, in what turned out to be his last ever public appearance before he died. Then a year later, I brought out his widow, Wendy, for a touching tribute to her husband. She was accompanied by Ronnie's best friend, Geezer Butler, which left me a little gobsmacked. I'd been a Geezer fan for years, but had never met him.
"I know you," he said in his lazy Birmingham accent. "I've been watching you on Dancing with the Stars. I even voted for you."
Yes! Anyone who thought my appearance on DWTS wasn't metal could now suck it forever because the Geezer Butler voted for me. My time on DWTS was more metallically validated when Alice Cooper walked on stage and told everyone to vote for me. "Chris is doing more to bring metal to the mainstream than anybody here right now. A vote for him is a vote for heavy metal." Alice was right, and the fact I was on DWTS the same week Zach Wilde appeared on American Idol, playing with my buddy James Durbin, a gig I helped set up, was one of the signs of the metalocalypse. Zack is my brother, and we always have a blast together, and he saved the day one year when Alice pulled out of the opening segment just minutes before the start of the show. Josh and I had written a skit where I would come on stage and thank myself for doing such a great job as host every year. I'd slowly build my speech and get the crowd sick of my bravado. Then at the right moment, Alice would come out, whip me with his riding crop, and chase me away. For some reason, Alice decided he didn't want to do the skit and pulled out 30 minutes before showtime. Josh was freaking out, but I calmed him down and sent him to find Zack. Wild and I are a couple of idiots with the same sense of humor, and I knew we could figure out something quickly. After a few minutes of brainstorming, I walked on stage and delivered the same speech I'd planned with Alice, except it was Zack who came out and interrupted me. Obviously, Zack doesn't have a riding crop. Maybe he could have used his beard. So I had him cut me off by calling me a douche. "Hi, Zack, what are you..."
"Douche."
"Wait, you can't..."
"Douche."
"Hold on, Zack, you..."
"Douche, douche, douche."
It was an interesting idea to have the host be the butt of the joke, as I was the guy who had to gain the audience's trust and control the ebb and flow of the show. But it worked. It showed the crowd that I had no problem taking the piss out of myself, and that gave me a better connection with those who didn't know me and thought I was just a wrestler guy. I also had the experience to improv and go with the flow when things unexpectedly changed, no matter what was thrown at me. Case in point, I had just come off stage after introducing Deftones when Josh ran over in a flurry.
"Joe Perry is coming and wants to be on the show."
"Wow, okay. If the legendary guitar player from Aerosmith wants to be on the show, then we better find something for him to do." I had an idea. We had 20 minutes to figure out what we were going to do before Deftones were done and I was due back on stage. So Josh and I hustled down to the underground parking garage, and by the time Joe Perry showed up, we had only about 7 minutes to put something together. Joe got out of the limo and stared off into space like he could give two shits about the whole thing. I'd never met him before, so I figured that was just his personality. Either that or he was stoned. Maybe both. Josh was being diplomatic and cordial, as he should have been, considering he was in charge. But I had a show to run and only a few minutes to get things figured out, so I had no time for formalities. "Hey, Joe," I said to one of the most famous guitar players in rock history, "here's what I'd like you to do, as it's been kind of a running joke on the show. I'm going to go on stage and talk about myself, and when you're ready, walk out to the mic and call me a douche. Can you do that?" Joe stared at me calmly and took a drag from his cigarette.
"Yeah, I can call you a douche."
Not exactly the first thing you want a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame to say to you, but I didn't have time to think of anything else. I hit the stage just as Deftones singer Chino Moreno and a dead ringer for Batista walked off and started into the same spiel I used earlier about how great I was. The crowd grew restless until finally Joe Perry glided on stage. They erupted as he sauntered over to the podium, reached into his pocket, and lit up a joint. He leaned into the mic and I got a lungful of secondhand THC as I waited for him to call me a douche. He surveyed the crowd and glanced over at me, preparing to deliver his line. "Jericho," he said, and I smiled in anticipation of how the audience was going to erupt when he put me in my place. "You need to save the Australian Aborigines. Go to worldpeace.org to find out how you can help." What the hell was he talking about? That wasn't in the script. "Oh, and by the way, Jericho, you're a motherfucking douche." The crowd loved it, and so did Joe as he took another drag of a spliff and wandered off the stage with a smirk. I haven't seen or spoken to him since. It wasn't an easy task to be the master of ceremonies of the GGs, but the job got even harder when I pulled double duty and played the show one year when Fozzy was invited to kick off the festivities. We decided to open with a medley of songs by the greatest metal bands of all time: Sabbath, Priest, Ozzy, Metallica, Maiden, Pantera, and Dio, and then segue into our own tune, God Pounds His Nails from Chasing the Grail. To start things off with a bang, we were going to pull our old Smash the Boombox with a Baseball Bat routine that we'd done at the Astoria in London years earlier. The show would start with a spotlight shining on a stool with a boombox on it. A roadie would walk on stage and press play, and Justin Bieber's Baby would blast through the speakers. The crowd would, of course, boo the shit out of it, until I came out on stage with a bat over my shoulder and smashed the hell out of the tape player as the band hit an open chord in time with my blows. We were ready to go as the lights went out and the crowd buzzed, except we'd forgotten to find a roadie to press play on the boombox. Dave Grohl had just showed up backstage to hang out, so I grabbed him by the arm and asked him to do the honors. He was totally fruit with it and wandered on